This is VOA News by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin will be using his first ministerial meeting with NATO allies Wednesday to try to repair the frayed relationship, acknowledging that longstanding ties were at times strained under former President Donald Trump. The change in tone and approach, as senior defense officials described it Tuesday, comes as the United States and NATO are staring down major decisions on force levels in Afghanistan and on how to best confront powers like Russia and China, which remain set on bending international norms in their favor. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg signaled a desire to reset the U.S.-NATO relationship early this month. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the path to diplomacy is open right now with Iran over its 2015 nuclear deal, but he would not address whether the Biden administration has had any direct engagement with Iranian officials. Asked if there was any move underway to resume direct diplomacy, Blinken pointed to President Biden's public stance that if Iran resumes compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal, so would the United States. In 2018, former President Donald Trump abandoned the nuclear deal, which limited Iran's nuclear enrichment activity to make it harder for Tehran to develop nuclear arms, an ambition Iran has long denied having in return for the easing of U.S. and other sanctions. When Trump left the deal, which Iran struck with six major powers, he reimposed crippling sanctions on Iran's economy. Iran has told the U.N. nuclear watchdog it will scale back cooperation with it in a week, ratcheting up protests against U.S. sanctions, still choking its economy. Via remote, this is VOA News. Britain is expected Wednesday to call on the U.N. Security Council to push for temporary ceasefires and conflict zones to enable the rolling out of vaccines against the coronavirus. Britain holds the chairmanship of the Security Council this month. Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has said his ceasefire resolution would also demand equitable access to coronavirus vaccines for nations around the world. In a statement, Raab emphasized the need to help inoculate more than 160 million people in conflict zones such as Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, and Ethiopia. Raab said nations have a moral duty to act and a strategic necessity to come together to defeat this virus. Meanwhile, Brazil's environment minister tested positive for COVID-19 on Tuesday. He is the least of the 15th person of President Jair Bolsonaro's cabinet to be diagnosed with the disease since the pandemic began. Well, two U.S. Senate committees announced they will hold a hearing next week to investigate security lapses that failed to prevent last month's rampage at the U.S. Capitol by hundreds of supporters of former President Trump. His supporters stormed past outmanned law enforcement officers, many vandalizing the building in mayhem that led five people dead, including a Capitol Police officer whose death is being investigated as a homicide. The announcement of the Senate hearing comes a day after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives, said an independent September 11th-style commission would be formed to look into the causes of the mayhem at the Capitol and the interference with the peaceful transfer of power from Trump to Biden. The Senate last weekend acquitted Trump of an impeachment charge that he incited insurrection in the storming of the Capitol. U.S. pharmaceutical and biotechnology company Moderna said it will supply the second batch of 100 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the U.S. by the end of May instead of the original delivery date of June. Delivery date for a third batch also has been moved forward by 2 months to late July from late September. Overall, the U.S. has distributed upwards of 70 million doses of vaccine, and the number of more than 52 million doses have been administered, according to the Centers for Disease Control. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us on our website, voanews.com. Also, additional information on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, reporting via remote, VOA News.
Everybody Africa, welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Mixed signals from South Africa and the WHO on AstraZeneca vaccine.
Today, WHO gave emergency use listing to two versions of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, giving the green light for these vaccines to be rolled out globally through COVAX.
The WHO says actions are underway to control the latest Ebola outbreak in Africa. Tensions mount between Ethiopia and Sudan. The trial of Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda starts today, Wednesday, in Kigali. The trial of two Central African Republic war crime suspects is underway at the ICC. And Uganda's Bobi Wine will petition the UN Human Rights Office in Kampala.
We want to join the voices that are demanding for the immediate unconditional release of the Ugandans that are being held in various detention centers.
And France will not withdraw troops from the Sahel. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Mixed signals from South Africa and the World Health Organization on the main vaccine expected to be used by the developing world. This week, the global organization approved the emergency use of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Meanwhile, South Africa, which earlier this month received 1 million doses, is reportedly looking to return their stock after a trial showed disappointing results. VOA's Anita Power brings us up to speed from Johannesburg.
Africa's viral epicenter, South Africa, confirmed Tuesday that it is jettisoning its plans to use the AstraZeneca vaccine and will switch to a different one. That announcement came a day after the vaccine, which is the leading choice for the developing world, received emergency use authorization from the World Health Organization. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
Today, WHO gave emergency use listing to two versions of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, giving the green light for these vaccines to be rolled out globally through COVAX. WHO emergency use listing assesses and assures the quality, safety, and efficacy of COVID-19 vaccines and is a prerequisite for vaccines to be distributed by COVAX. This listing was completed in just under 4 weeks from the time WHO received the full dossiers from the manufacturers. In addition to the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, these are now the second and third vaccines to receive emergency use listing. We now have all the pieces in place for the rapid distribution of vaccines.
But South Africa's experience with the AstraZeneca vaccine has been far from smooth or encouraging. The nation carries the bulk of the continent's cases, with 1.49 million confirmed cases. Earlier this month, South Africa received 1 million doses of the promising vaccine at a price of just over $5 each. That is nearly three times the amount the EU members are paying for the same vaccine, according to information leaked by European officials. When the vaccine arrived on a rainy February day, South African officials were also startled to discover that this batch of vaccines, which has a six-month storage life, was set to expire in April. That discovery was followed by the disappointing announcement that a study conducted in South Africa found that this vaccine is not totally effective against the highly contagious variant of the virus that is prevalent in the country. And so, on Tuesday, South African health officials announced that they would receive a shipment of 80,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine later in the day and begin inoculating health workers on Wednesday. Health Minister Zweli Mkhize told local media that another 420,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine would land in the next 4 weeks, along with another 20 million doses of the two-shot Pfizer vaccine. The nation plans to inoculate 40 million people, about 67% of the population. And what of that huge stockpile of AstraZeneca vaccines? On Tuesday, the deputy health minister denied reports that the government has asked the manufacturer to take back all 1 million doses. South Africa will reportedly try to trade them with countries that do not have high incidence of the variant, known as B1351 or 501YV2. Dr. Kate O'Brien, the WHO's director of immunization vaccines and biologicals, said this vaccine may still prove useful elsewhere.
Countries remain enthusiastic about receiving the AstraZeneca product, while at the same time, you know, asking very relevant questions about what the evidence shows and what the evidence doesn't show. And I'll just reinforce that there is no evidence on whether or not the AstraZeneca product against the B1351 variant has any change, or if the change in the efficacy is of a substantial change. And there are plausible reasons why we think that there will retain activity against severe disease.
South African authorities said Tuesday that first in line for the Wednesday shot would be frontline healthcare workers at public and private clinics across the country. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization says actions are underway to control two separate outbreaks of the deadly Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Guinea in West Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The outbreak in Guinea was detected February 14th, just 1 week after a new outbreak of Ebola was identified in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The two outbreaks are unrelated, but the World Health Organization says both face similar challenges and both can benefit from new treatments and recent experiences. The WHO reports seven family members who attended a burial ceremony in the town of Gweke, Guinea, were infected with the virus, and three have since died. WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris says 115 contacts have been identified, and the majority have been traced.
Confidence with the experience and expertise built during the previous outbreaks that the health teams in Guinea are on the move to quickly trace the path of the virus and curb further infections, but it certainly will be a big job. And WHO is supporting the Guinean authorities to set up testing, contact tracing, treatment structures, and to bring the overall response to full speed.
Harris says WHO offices in surrounding countries have been contacted and preparedness plans are being put in place. The 2014 West African Ebola outbreak began in Guinea and quickly spread to neighboring Sierra Leone and Liberia. By the time the epidemic ended in 2016, 28,000 people had been infected with the disease and more than 11,000 had died. Harris says many lessons have been learned from previous outbreaks to keep the virus from spreading. She says it is important to have a strategic response plan, get it into action early, and to coordinate all aspects of the operation.
What is critical is decentralizing the operations to the lowest level, making sure your operations are where the community are, and that the community owns the operations, that your work is community-centered, and that you work with the community. A one-size-fits-all approach to community engagement isn't effective.
Turning to the other Ebola outbreak, the World Health Organization has confirmed four cases, including two deaths in the city of Butembo in DRC's North Kivu province. The WHO reports nearly 300 contacts have been identified and tracing is underway. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The trial of Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda and 20 other suspects starts today, Wednesday, in the capital, Kigali. Rusesabagina, who was portrayed in the movie Hotel Rwanda because of his humanitarian work during the Rwanda 1994 genocide, was arrested in August 2020 while in transit in Ethiopia and extradited to Rwanda. He is charged with 13 criminal offenses for his alleged connection to the FLN, the militia group that the Rwandan government accuses of terrorism. Rwandan authorities said the trial will be live streamed via YouTube. Rusesabagina's lawyers have asked for postponement of the trial on grounds that he had not been given enough time to prepare for the trial. The lawyers also asked for his provisional release for medical treatment. Anaïs Kaniba is Rusesabagina's daughter. She says the trial has been a sham trial from the very beginning.
This is a sham trial, so I do not expect much from what's going to happen today. I hope that the judge will do what he has to do and not rule on the motions that the lawyers have sent. These motions really kind of describe all the violations that have happened so far, including the kidnapping of my father. So I hope that when they go in front of the judge, he can respond to that. If not, you know, he needs to be released immediately. So I don't have lots of expectation for this trial, as it's a sham trial.
Your dad is demanding provisional release because he says that his rights as a defendant have been violated. What are those rights?
First of all, he was kidnapped. He was illegally arrested. And that's the very first issue of this whole trial. Had any kind of real court, the way he was arrested would have already finished this trial and he would not be in front of the court. So he's asking that, first of all, the judge reviews again the way he was arrested, the illegal arrest, that the judge reviews all the violations thus far, including the fact that he didn't have a lawyer for over 70 days, that he's only seen his lawyer for 6 times, that his documents have been confiscated. So he's, at the minimum, they're asking for a medical bail or, you know, a delay of the trial date so he can have more time to prepare. But the most important thing for the judge to realize is that this is not a fair trial, given that he was kidnapped. And anywhere in the world, if you kidnap somebody to put them on trial, that trial will not go further.
So, Anaïs, what is your dad's position in terms of these charges against him, including financing terrorism and being a member of a terrorist group, as well as murder and arson? What is your dad's reaction still to these charges?
Well, until now, his position, my father, again, they say that he has, in what the Rwandans saying, that he's already admitted to some of the allegations. Again, that should not count because the admissions of these allegations were done under duress. This was done when he didn't have his legal counsel choosing. This is when he was under with David Rugaza and Emmeline, these two lawyers who were working for the government. And they also, we learned that in the indictment that they also used statement that he did under duress also when he was tortured. So to remind you, for those who don't know, you know, he was kidnapped. He was taken on 27th. For 3 days, he was held incommunicado. And in those 3 days, they got statements out of him, which they are using against him in this trial. So again, this is another example and reason why this is a sham trial. They're using evidence collected on somebody under torture.
Can your dad refuse? I mean, is he going to show up in court today, Wednesday? Will he show up?
Well, he has to show up. We believe he's gonna show up with Maître Gatera Gashabana, and we'll ask the question to the judge of what is his stand on the motions, and then we'll see what they say. But yes, he will be present in court. But again, you know, what happened in Kigali, a lot of things changes very fast. To my knowledge, he's supposed to be there, but we'll see.
Before I let you go, how is your dad's health, and when last did you speak with him?
He's doing a little bit better, but his health, and when I say doing better mentally, you know, he's doing better. He feels confident. You know, he knows all the support that he has outside. He knows that the EU, for instance, passed a resolution last week, you know, condemning the illegal arrest and the detention so far. And so that gave him a lot of courage. But his health, you know, we still don't know what medication he's taking. And so in the last calls, he said he still has a dizziness. Earlier in January, he had feared of dying of stroke because he was so sick. He hasn't said that in the last call. So that's why I feel like he's doing a little bit better. But, you know, we still are very concerned with COVID-19 really increasing in the country and prisons. We're still very concerned for his health.
Anaïs, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much, James, and thank you for your audience and keeping the story.
Anaïs Kanimba is the daughter of Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda. She was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 17. Ugandan opposition leader Robert Kyagulanyi said his party will petition the United Nations Human Rights Office in Kampala over the disappearances and arrest of his supporters. Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, is the head of the National Unity Platform, or NUP party. He says most of his supporters are now living in fear following the January 14 presidential elections, which the Elections Commission says he lost to incumbent Yoweri Museveni. Meanwhile, Ugandan police said those arrested will be charged for heinous crimes, including treason and terrorism. Mugumi Davis Rakarinji has more from Kampala.
Kyagulanyi says most of his supporters were arrested before or after the disputed January 14 elections.
According to our statistics, more than 3,000 Ugandans have been kidnapped. Many of our leaders, supporters, and close allies are living in fear. Many of them are in hiding. While as we speak, we know that by the end of this press conference, we are going to get reports of many more that are being kidnapped.
In a nationwide speech over the weekend, President Yoweri Museveni told the nation that close to 300 people were arrested during the January 14 election campaign period. He said many of them have since been released, with only less than 100 still in custody pending investigations in what he said are terrorism crimes. Colonel Seron Jeju Damula, the director of intelligence, while addressing journalists on Monday, February 15, corroborated the president's claims. He said the police are holding dozens of people involved in several acts of violence and terrorism-related crimes.
Following the announcement of results, we had a number of incidents of throwing petrol bombs at Nsanji. Nsanji is along Masaka Road. Vehicles were targeted, people were targeted by goonies that were holding petrol bombs. They also used meshed nails to disable vehicles on that road. Secondly, we have been receiving cases of people throwing letters to homes of a number of people, warning them of death.
Colonel Damuria said the suspects will be produced in courts of law. Human rights attorney Anthony Masake says Ugandan laws grant rights to suspects irrespective of the alleged crimes.
A key pillar of these rights is the presumption of innocence, and that requires that if the police suspects that someone has committed a crime, they should come and inform you the reasons for your arrest, and then proceed to arrest you within the confines of the law, and then take you to a police station.
Suspects are also supposed to be produced in court within 48 hours, according to Masake. Also says suspects have a right to access a family member, a lawyer, and a doctor. In recent days, many people have come out saying their relatives were detained incommunicado. Former presidential candidate Chagrin says he no longer trusts local courts.
We want to join the voices that are demanding for the immediate unconditional release of the Ugandans that are being held in various detention centers.
Chagrani, who was for several days prevented from leaving his house in the days following the January 14 elections, says he will take his petition to the UN Human Rights Office in Kampala today, Wednesday. It is not clear if the police will allow Chagrani to do so. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
Sudan this week accused Ethiopian troops of an incursion across the border over a land dispute between the two neighbors. The border dispute adds to tensions over Ethiopia's hydropower dam on a Nile River tributary that Egypt and Sudan say threatened their supply of fresh water. Naba Muhideen reports from Khartoum.
This week, Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs issued a communique saying Ethiopia made what the ministry called a disrespectful incursion into Sudanese lands. Ethiopian troops allegedly crossed the border at Al-Fashaga, an area that sits on the border between northwestern Ethiopia and eastern Sudan. The Ethiopian government didn't deny the incursion, but called on Sudan to stop its own incursions across the border. The dispute over Al-Fashaga goes back at least 50 years, but has flared up again since December, shortly after tens of thousands of refugees from Ethiopia's embattled Tigray region began crossing into eastern Sudan. In January, Sudan said an Ethiopian military aircraft overflew its territory, while Ethiopia accused Sudanese troops of crossing the border and looting from Ethiopian citizens. However, Sudanese political analyst Abbas Mohammed, based in Qatar, thinks both Sudan and Ethiopia could not stand the cost of a real war. Mohammed says decision makers in Sudan and Ethiopia know very well that going to war is nonsensical. There is economic development in Ethiopia and democratic change in Khartoum. Any war would threaten the gains in the two countries, but the ruling leaders are looking for enemy to defuse the internal conflicts. The border dispute adds to existing tensions over Ethiopia's hydropower dam on the Nile River tributary. Egypt and Sudan say the dam would reduce the flow downriver and threaten their supply of fresh water. Khartoum-based political analyst Al-Fatih Mahmoud says the dam is the driving factor behind the tensions. Mahmoud says the Ghur dam is the reason behind it, and that dispute could push the two parties into a skirmish and to sit together at a negotiation table, though it never has resulted in a war. Sudan and Ethiopia have welcomed an initiative by South Sudan to mediate the border dispute. However, Ethiopia said it wants an immediate withdrawal by Sudan's military from the border area in exchange for starting negotiations. Naba Muhideen for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
France says it will not draw down its troops' presence in Africa's Sahel region, despite earlier reports that it could bring home hundreds of soldiers following significant gains against extremists. Nicolas Pinault reports from Paris.
Addressing via video conference regional leaders from Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, and Chad, French President Emmanuel Macron said there will be no immediate reduction of French troops in the Sahel.
Je considère que précipiter un retrait français, en tout cas,
Macron said that reducing French troops too quickly and massively from the region, which is a possibility he studied, will be a mistake. So in the coming months, nothing will change, the French president assured. The pullback of the additional 600 French troops deployed in early 2020 is still on the table and will be discussed later this year. Their probable departure will not have a negative impact, but a change in strategy is needed, according to Nicolas Normand, a former ambassador of France to Mali.
The impact on the ground should be limited, I think, because the European force called Takuba can take over and replace those French military. French forces, Barkhane, were so far too independent. The military involvement of the Sahelian forces themselves is not sufficient. So this implies a new type of cooperation with them. There is a need to make them more effective, to equip them.
After the recent killings of top jihadist leaders linked to Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, France also will intensify its efforts to help decapitate these organizations on the ground. General Dominique Trinquant is former head of French military mission to the United Nations.
Il y a un appel au renforcement de la lutte de façon globale.
He says President Macron is calling to reinforce the global fight against terrorism, and using the term decapitate refers to targeted missions to eliminate jihadist leaders. To launch such operations, they would use intelligence provided by U.S. and French drones and local armies. Currently, 5,100 French soldiers fight extremist groups alongside African and European soldiers in the region. An additional 1,200 Chadian soldiers will soon be deployed in the zone bordering Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. More than 50 French soldiers have been killed since 2013 while fighting extremists in the region. A new G5 Sahel summit is scheduled to take place later this year. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
And that's it for this Wednesday, February 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a good day.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.